This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The theme park industry is big business in Central Florida, and some of the innovations you'll see in theme parks and attractions can cross over into other industries too.
You know, there are a lot of industries that are crossing over to try to get into this. And part of it is because there's a ton of money in tourism. But, you know, a lot of the technologies, like Seth said, are starting to cross. A lot of this kind of helps other industries, so there's a lot of money to be picked in there.
And attractions doesn't only mean big theme parks. Right. These are things that can spread out to little family entertainment centers and arcades and, you know, in small towns. Things can be incorporated into movie theaters, even museums.
The International Association of Amusement Parks and Attractions kicks off its conference in Orlando. More than 1,000 exhibitors at the Orange County Convention Center. Industry insiders gather to see the latest in rides and technology. We're here to talk about it. With us more is Rich Bilbao. He covers the theme park industry for the Orlando Business Journal. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Also joined by Seth Kuberski. He is the Orlando Weekly's arts and culture columnist. Thank you so much, Seth.
Pleasure to talk to you with you.
Rich, start us off. Disney and Universal are the big names in Central Florida. Mm-hmm. Is this conference for them?
This is actually a conference for anyone in the industry, really. You know, you always think about the Disney's Universals, but this is the guy who builds the light bulbs that goes into an attraction, the guy who builds the tracks, the food, the cotton candy maker. One of the things this year is called, it's basically like a hamster wheel. You jump inside, you're running the hamster wheel, and it'll mix your own margarita or something. Huh. Have you heard about that?
A snow cone machine.
Yeah,
yeah, a giant snow cone machine, and that's a local guy. He put his thing together and showed it off
hamster
at Maker Faire.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually been on display out at that event they have outside the Orlando Science Center, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's anyone in the industry. Now, you know, the Disney's Universals will be there because they'll be looking at what's the next tech available. Mm-hmm. But this goes all the way down to the, you know, carnival guys or the guys who run like family entertainment centers. This is anybody in that industry.
How long have you been covering this event for?
Ooh, this might be my fifth year, probably. Mm-hmm.
I think this is going to be number 10 for me.
Well, we're counting numbers here.
So, Seth, how's it changed in the last decade?
Well, the biggest change is that it's just gotten bigger. It takes up one of the largest halls inside the convention center, and every single year they add square footage. My pedometer just gives up and cries every year. You can easily do 10 or 15 miles of walking just in a day, walking up and down the aisles, not even stopping to look at anything, just trying to cover all of the space. And the other thing that's changed over the years is they've added more and more seminars, panels, educational sessions so that it's more than just a marketplace of people trying to sell stuff. But it's a lot of networking and it's a lot of people sharing ideas about what's coming up in the future of the industry.
So what are you most excited about at IAAPA this year, Seth?
Well, you know, I could be sophisticated and say there's some new form of technology or a particular piece of ride hardware. But to be honest, what I'm always most interested in is the food. If you are into things that are terrible for you, things that are fried, things that have lots of sugar, it's literally Candyland. Because this is where park operators go to purchase the equipment and the ingredients to make the stuff that they're going to sell you to make you fat while waiting in line for their rides. One that I'm especially looking forward to this year is Beaver Tails. They made a comeback a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
If you are an old school Epcot fan, you might remember they used to sell Beaver Tails outside the Canadian Pavilion in Epcot. And they're just fried, doughy goodness with sugar and chocolate and all sorts of wonderful, terrible things. And this year they're introducing a new kind of food cart so that they'll hopefully be able to sell Beaver Tails into smaller fairs and traveling carnivals and spread the Beaver Tail goodness all over the world. So I can't wait to try a sample or seven.
That's interesting. So like you were saying, Rich, it's literally kind of the soup to nuts of the industry, everything from the food carts all the way up to the roller coasters.
Yeah, I mean, it's anything that you can think of that a theme park will need to operate. And everyone thinks it might be like the latest roller coaster cart or the technology that goes into like a laser show. I mean, you'll see those there. But I mean, it is anything, the nuts and bolts, like you said, the oven that goes into making this thing or the certain technology to dispense better drinks faster, you know, even the Magic Band technology, anything that goes into or admission technology, whatever it is that is within the industry itself, how it works, how the lights turn on, lights turn off every night. That is what you'll find here.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the innovations are about trying to reduce friction points that maybe as a guest you're not consciously aware of, But going through a turnstile and having to pause to get a ticket scanned or trying to get a souvenir photo and having to stand in a line. There's a lot of technologies, wireless systems, new face scanning systems, and those sort of things are introduced first at IAPA to try to get park operators interested in buying these things. They're not sexy. You can't put it on a billboard, but they're the kind of things that help increase revenue and increase efficiency in parks. And that's where your money comes from in the end.
Do you get people who aren't part of the theme park industry taking a look at some of these things? Because if you're talking about friction points, face scanning technology, ways of getting people from A to B faster, I can see other industries would be interested in some of that technology too.
Yeah, the majority of people are associated with the attractions industry. But, you can buy a day pass for $60 or $75. And you will also see people from other industries, whether it's an entertainment industry or just a service industry, people get ideas from the attractions, and that spreads out into the rest of society.
Yeah, I've seen guys there who were creating simulations for like military contractors. It's kind of a reverse of what you're asking, but military contractor guys who have instead used their technology to do when you're designing a roller coaster, work with us. We'll make the whole simulation of a roller coaster, get in our VR chair that'll move and turn and ride your ride before you build it to make sure that you ironed out all the kinks. So there are, there are a lot of industries that are crossing over to try to get into this. And part of it is because there's a ton of money in tourism. But, a lot of the technologies, like Seth said, are starting to cross. Mm-hmm. A lot of this kind of helps other industries. So there's a lot of money to be picked in there.
And attractions doesn't only mean big theme parks. These are things that can spread out to little family entertainment centers and arcades and, in small towns. Things can be incorporated into movie theaters, even museums. I know that Falcon's Creative is there this year, and they're talking about work that they've been doing with National Geographic to take things like museums, the Church of the Sepulchre in Jerusalem, and the National Geographic Ocean Experience in New York City, and to do these things without actual artifacts, without actual animals, but to use 3D projections and technology to recreate these things that you used to only find in a museum or an aquarium.
Mm-hmm. Is that partly because museums are now having to compete, to make their attractions more flashy to compete with what theme parks are doing? Because you go to some of these museums these days, and it is like being in an immersive kind of theme park style experience in some cases.
Immersion and interactivity are two words that you will hear over and over in IAPA. Mm-hmm. And it's, people are no longer satisfied with just sitting in a chair that shakes or sitting and looking at a picture and reading a little description. They want all of their senses to be stimulated. And, that kind of started with the theme park industry, but it's permeated all forms of entertainment and even daily life now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's about being part of the experience now, like playing a role in the experience now. Disney did this for decades. I mean, they helped put you into this world. But I think, a perfect recent example, and Seth, I don't know if you agree with me, but I mean, it was the Harry Potter stuff.
Sure.
I mean, once that world was opened up and you can buy, the clothing and the wands and you can interact with windows and they would make spells. I mean, that was the emergence of how do we bring the guests into the world of theme parks? It's no longer you just wait in line, or even the lines themselves, actually. The lines themselves have evolved into queue areas. Mm-hmm. How do we hang out? How do we sit around in areas like Fast and Furious Garage? We're gonna see the cars. How do we? And it's those things, and how do we bring those people into the world instead of just making them feel like they're waiting for something that's kind of painted, like the walls are just painted? How do we make the whole world come alive?
And it's interesting, at IAPA in the last couple of years, and I think we're going to see this come to a head this coming week, is that there's two diverging thoughts of how you create that immersion. One is with technology, with things like virtual reality and augmented reality, and we've seen lots of big bulky headsets and, people looking at 3D visuals. And the other side is with high touch and things that are highly interactive and highly personal and, maybe rely on actors and more labor in that sense.
Yeah.
And so you see that conflict at IAPA, and you see how that starts with the big parks like the Disney's, the Universal's, but there's stuff at all price points now. You can buy a virtual reality system, for less than a car stereo. And so once that stuff becomes a bit ubiquitous and everyone's got a virtual reality headset sitting on their coffee table, then what's the next thing that drags people into a theme park and away from their home?
So is there still a place, though, for the old-school roller coaster? I mean, you mentioned virtual reality, and as you say, the various companies have been experimenting by trying to, you know, make their roller coasters a little more sophisticated, have people strap on headsets. Is that technology blend working, or does sometimes people just want to jump on a roller coaster and go fast?
Well, me personally, I feel that the bigger the roller coaster, the less well VR works. I wasn't crazy when they added virtual reality to the big Kraken roller coaster at Busch Gardens, but on the little Freedom Flyer roller coaster at Fun Spot, I think it works well. What I think, even though you do see a lot more virtual reality headsets, you're going to see Legoland adding virtual reality to one of their roller coasters now. But I still think there's a place for old school physical thrills. There's a company showing off a cloud coaster, which is like an indoor zip line that goes right through a Ferris wheel. There's another company called Polen out of Germany that has a Ferris wheel water slide. It's a rotating water slide that you can't even wrap your brain around it just looking at the video. So I want to see a model of how something like this works.
Is there going to be a mock-up that you can actually jump on and try, or is it a bit too big for that?
I think there might be a hamster being able to slide through it, or maybe a gerbil. But for every 3D, for every projection, for every high-tech, someone else is coming up with something that's physical and grounded in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't feel a loop. You can't feel a loop unless you're on it. You can't feel a dip unless you're on it. Like there's a lot of ways that VR can play with your senses, but you can't feel that stomach drop when you take a dip. I to kind of put a little caveat on that and to put a little kudos to Disney, I kind of felt that with the Avatar ride, Flight of Passage.
There's a drop. It's a little Tower of Terror when it goes up and down.
It is there, but you can't recreate a thrill ride yet with technology. And that's why I think there's still going to be people who are coaster heads and they're all into it. So that'll still be something that's popular. Mm-hmm. But I think we're seeing a sort of a balance now. How do we bring in a ride that we can create using film and VR and subtle technology in a smaller space and a footprint? Because let's be honest, a roller coaster takes a ton of space. Mm-hmm. And how do we maximize that space?
Is there a place, too, for sort of nostalgia rides? Because Disney, they sometimes retire old rides, and then people who've been going to Disney for years and years and years get upset and say, I want to go back to that ride. Like, is there a place for rides that just are low-tech and they stay low-tech and people know what they're getting?
This is a touchy subject,
It's a double-edged sword because Disney, and to a lesser extent Universal, they rely on nostalgia and creating these emotional bonds in order to get you to keep coming back every year and paying that ticket price. But on the other hand, there's limited amount of space, especially at Universal. There's always got to be something new and fresh. I would love a Yesterday Land park where I can go and ride Mr. Toad's Wild Ride and 20,000 Leagues and Jaws
Is that the one with the submarines, 20,000 Leagues?
Yeah. That's
the original Alien Encounter.
Alien Encounter.
Yeah.
But there's a fan base that is ready to be exploited, and they certainly go and buy the retro T-shirts every time the merchandise becomes available. But I think the general public that really turns the turnstiles, they want things that are new and fresh, and they want to keep moving forward.
I think it's also based on age. Kids don't relate to those characters anymore. Mm-hmm. Mr. Toad's, while we remember it, kid doesn't know who that is. They know the Guardians of the Galaxy. They know Elsa from Frozen. Rest in peace, Maelstrom. You can't fault a theme park for saying, look, we have to move on. We have to bring in characters that are new generation of visitors believe or understand and know. So it's kind of a weird give and take. And I think as we get older, it kind of hurts, but at the same time, if you understand the industry, you know that it just has to happen. You have to freshen up. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those where you just say, okay, well, hopefully this new experience that replaces it is just as good.
I don't know if I could handle like an updated Carousel of Progress, though.
I was just thinking that.
I don't think that's a ride you can really update.
But come on, how do you feel when they get to the future part of it? And it's like supposed to be like 3 years ago, and they have like grandma has like a high score and stuff. When you watch it, you're like, oh boy.
I think that's part of the experience that people enjoy, though. I enjoy it anyway. Yeah.
The high-tech world of car phones and laserdisc players.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so there are other technologies that theme parks roll out. As Seth was saying, some of it's more basically getting people from A to B, keeping them comfortable. Rich, I noticed you were tweeting about some new patents that they're in the works. For example, some deployable shade.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
Sure,
throwing shade.
Yeah, right? Disney, I guess, one of their recent patents is, like you mentioned, it's a deployable shade. So imagine a light pole that would open from the top, sort of like the... Like a spaceship, open from the top, and an umbrella would come out, and it would open up, and it provides, I believe the number was around 12 feet of shade. And according to the patent, that's Disney's way of being able to provide cover for bad weather or for just really hot days to guests and still save space. And so it's trying to adapt to the environment while still being able to enhance the experience for guests. So will that happen? I don't know. I mean, there's a ton of patents that we write about that I always have to mention, hey, this might be just them saving that idea, mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, it's Disney and these guys are probably thinking of whatever's happening 20 years from now. But it's definitely one of those where if this happens, it sounds like it'd be really great for the experience and would definitely add to just the overall, you know, just it doesn't have to be a new ride. It's just one of those where it's just like, hey, it was a really hot day, but we're happy that Disney opened up that umbrella and it made that moment, you know, greater.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Disney is that while Universal is constantly building a new ride or a new hotel, Disney often does little infrastructure things that the average guest might not notice, but it kind of leads to overall comfort, such as the rebuilding of the hub around the castle mm-hmm. in recent years. No one was really clamoring for that, but now that it's done, it's hard to imagine going back to the old hub, which was so much more crowded during things like parades.
We talk about Universal and Disney, but what about SeaWorld? I'm wondering if there's any kind of new technology that you might see a glimpse of at IAAPA that SeaWorld might be thinking of to revamp and revitalize.
I think SeaWorld might need magic and not technology in order to help them, especially with the release of the emails from their previous executives.
SeaWorld's got a lot of problems that they're dealing with. They're stuck in this situation where they have an Ali versus Frasier fight between Disney and Universal, and they're just like the welterweight trying to like cut in there.
They're holding the water bucket in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, and it's one of those situations where what can they do to get out of the spiral that they're in? I don't know if that's where you're kind of going with that, but it's one of those where SeaWorld is just, you know, where do they go from here? I mean,
So you don't see a technology fix or something that they can build that can get people back into the park?
The problem is that SeaWorld has tried technology fixes over and over again the last few years. They built the Antarctica ride, which was the first major trackless ride, a huge technological advance for the Orlando market, and it kind of landed with a thud because while the technology was cool, it wasn't really used to great effect. Same sort of thing with their Kraken VR this summer. Got some publicity, got some long, slow lines for it, but it really wasn't something that appealed to the vast majority of people who are going to their park. They've got this Infinity Falls water slide, River Rapids ride. I don't even know if that's enough. I think the problem is that people go to SeaWorld for the animals.
Yep.
But the animals are also what makes them controversial.
Yeah.
So they're really caught between a rock and a hard place.
It comes to a point of, to open up the can of worms on SeaWorld is, it takes a lot to make a successful theme park. You have to have the capital to invest. You have to invest consistently. And then you have to also hit it out of the park because when you're competing against a Disney and Universal, you cannot falter. Like Seth said, Antarctica was a neat idea. But if you looked at the renderings that we saw before the opening of the ride, they are completely different than what we got. And I don't know if that was a money problem or what, or maybe just it wasn't feasible, but what happened there ended up being something where I'll call ourselves critics for the sake of just what we do. We were kind of disappointed in what we got. And it's a cool ride to give them kudos, but the thing is that you need to bring your A game. And if you falter, you are behind. You know, and you have the whole controversy thing with the orcas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the world of theme parks, you need to have properties. You need to have characters. Mickey Mouse, Spider-Man, Darth Vader, Luke, Han Solo.
So if you take Shamu out of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Harry Potter, yeah. What does SeaWorld have? Shamu, which just happens to be the animal that is the focal point of their controversy. Yeah. I mean, what do you do there? I mean, they got Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
They've got Sesame Street. They'll be building a big Sesame Street expansion, and that's their Hail Mary throw,
But is that a big enough Hail Mary? And it's not all bad on SeaWorld. I mean, you got to remember, SeaWorld also has Busch Gardens. And to most people, Busch Gardens is still great. They get a lot of awards every year. So they're still doing great there. It just happens to be the SeaWorld brand that's just getting consistently hammered. And then the company itself is named after their most hammered brand. It's not just technology that's going to pull that out. It's going to be a series of a ton of different decisions that just have to fall in the right place.
Back to IAAPA. Seth Kaberski, busy week for you?
Oh, yeah. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday will be nothing but walking up and down the aisles over and over again. And there's also some interesting panels and presentations. There's a Hall of Fame induction ceremony. One of my favorite things that I'm looking forward to this year is the Legends panel, which is going to be Joe Rohde from Disney and executives from Universal talking about intellectual property in theme parks. So to hear the people between Harry Potter and Avatar talking about how that worked, that should be really interesting.
Rich, you'll be pretty tied up too with IAAPA, I imagine.
I am. In my end, it's more of just trying to find a lot of the local vendors that are there and kind of talking to them and how the event helps them out. And it's really just getting down there and seeing what's happening. I mean, it's a good way to see what is right on the edge of coming out in theme parks. So what are we seeing? What technologies are trending right now?
And speaking of local vendors, what's also interesting is seeing how many more. It's not just people coming in from out of town now. There's a lot of local companies. Yeah. You know, you got something like Dynamic Attractions that built Soarin' and the Harry Potter ride, and they've got a design center here in town.
Yep.
And hopefully I'll be able to sneak in there. They've been talking about doing some tours with the press.
Yeah, I know they're going to have an announcement there. SeaWorld will have their announcement, which I'm assuming will probably be the Infinity Falls car. And then there's a couple other local vendors and plenty of other. I mean, this is not just local guys. I mean, these are hundreds of companies that come from far across the globe. It's just one of those where, you know, what do you got? What are you bringing today? What do you got this year that's cutting edge?
Well, Rich Bilbao covers the theme park industry for the Orlando Business Journal. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem, man.
Also joined by Seth Kaberski, Orlando Weekly's arts and culture columnist. Thank you so much, Seth.
Thank you.
And 90.7's Brendan Byrne will be covering the International Association of Amusement Parks and Attractions Expo all this week too. We'll check in with him on Intersection on Friday. Still to come on Intersection.
There were a lot of growers that were about to plant their crops, but were actually holding back, waiting to see. As you know, we sat and watched Irma for what seemed like a very long time as it approached. So many growers made the decision to hold off until afterwards, and it was a very wise decision.
How is Florida agriculture bouncing back from Hurricane Irma 2 months on from the storm? And later in the show,
I really researched these cases. I went back, I read all the trial transcripts. I got interviews with as many of the people involved as I could. And it just really seemed to be a dark time for justice here in Brevard County in the 1980s.
Florida Today's John A. Torres on creating his podcast, Murder on the Space Coast. Don't miss a minute of Intersection. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can also listen on the NPR One app, and you can visit our website, WMFE.org. Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Hurricane Irma dealt a serious blow to Florida's citrus industry. Growers faced ruined crops and flooded groves, and the financial tally is huge. But Florida also produces a lot of other fresh fruits and vegetables that get shipped out to the rest of the United States over the winter. So how did those other growers fare in the storm, and how are they doing now, 2 months on? Well, Lisa Lockridge is the Director of Public Affairs for the Florida Fruit and Vegetable Association. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for letting me be here.
So Hurricane Irma dealt a blow to irrigation systems, fields, and other infrastructure in the growing industry in Central Florida. What kind of crops were worst affected?
Well, by far the biggest agricultural impact from Irma was to Florida's signature citrus industry. The hurricane just delivered a major body blow to citrus throughout the state. There was virtually no area of citrus-producing regions that weren't affected by the storm because it was just so big. And damages were estimated at more than $760 million to the industry. There were trees that had been stripped of their fruit, so much of the crop ended up on the ground, and then groves sat in standing water for days in the heat afterwards.
And as far as what you folks at the Florida Fruit and Vegetable Association deal with, is citrus a big part of that?
We do have citrus growers among our membership. However, our members represent the vast majority of fresh fruit and vegetable production in Florida. So citrus is certainly a component, but then we also have members from throughout the specialty crop industry in Florida.
So Lisa, when you look at some of the other crops that might have been affected from Hurricane Irma, are there some that stand out?
Well, fortunately, the picture is much brighter for vegetable producers and other fruit producers in the state in the aftermath of Irma. If there was any silver lining at all with regards to the hurricane, it was the timing. There just weren't many of those crops in the ground when Irma hit. So once the growers were able to get into their fields, repair the damage that had been done, you mentioned irrigation equipment and those kinds of things. So once they were able to get back into their fields and plant, they were back in the game.
What's the next biggest crop after citrus when you just say look at central Florida as far as agricultural production?
Well, Florida in general is the top producer of much of the fresh produce for the country in the wintertime. So right now, you're looking at production of numerous crops where we're going to be supplying the country with fruits and vegetables for the fall and winter. So you're talking about tomatoes and strawberries, bell peppers. Sweet corn is certainly a significant one. There's also watermelon, green beans, cucumbers, blueberries, cabbage, and squash. So a lot of people don't realize that we're sort of the fresh fruit and vegetable basket, during the winter months.
And had some of those crops been planted already when that storm rolled through?
There were a lot of growers that were about to plant their crops, but were actually holding back, waiting to see. As you know, we sat and watched Irma for what seemed like a very long time as it approached. So many growers made the decision to hold off until afterwards, and it was a very wise decision because otherwise they would have lost whatever was in the ground anyway.
When you look at some of the damage to infrastructure, how bad was that if you're talking about, you know, irrigation systems and things like that?
Well, in terms of the citrus industry, by far the crop losses themselves were the biggest piece of that damage figure. But certainly for farms across especially the southern area of the state, there was infrastructure damage to the irrigation equipment that was just stripped from the ground. There were packing houses that lost roofs, pieces of them peeled away. So there was definitely the kind of damage that you would expect with a Category 3 hurricane making landfall in a major agricultural production area in southwest Florida.
And as far as consumers are concerned, are we seeing or are consumers seeing any kind of an uptick in price as a result of the hurricane or a lack of certain kinds of fruits and veggies, or is it just business as usual?
Well, other than maybe a slight delay in the farmers being able to plant the crops, just recovering from Irma, consumers shouldn't notice much of a difference at the grocery store. There may be a little bit of a short supply right now because we're just getting into that growing season. But in the weeks to come, the growers expect to be back up to full production volume. So there shouldn't be noticeable differences heading into Thanksgiving and Christmas.
What about the farm workers? I'm wondering if there's what the kind of impact might have been for farm workers, whether it's for the fruit and veggie, whether it's for citrus. What are you hearing from some of the members from your association?
Well, this was certainly a devastating blow to the very important people who help us harvest our crops, the farm workers. You know, a lot of them had been evacuated, especially in South Florida with the hurricane coming, and many, many of them just lost their homes, damaged such that they could not return home. So the Florida Fruit and Vegetable Association alone raised about $120,000 just to meet basic needs in the days after Irma for some of these workers who were displaced. We're still dealing with the effects of those. And of course, they were without work for a while. And certainly, there's not as much citrus harvesting going on right now. So they have definitely been affected. It's something that we realize they're just an important part of what makes agriculture work here in Florida.
Has it been difficult to find folks to harvest some of the other crops as well?
Labor is a key issue for us, it's particularly labor shortages, and we were already experiencing those before Irma hit. We compete, our workers, they may want to go work in construction with Florida's building boom going on. So it's tough to find workers, in a good time, and particularly after Irma, we've seen that there are a shortage of workers, which just makes it that much more difficult to get the crops harvested.
One of the things we heard about the citrus industry after Hurricane Irma is that some farmers or some of the folks associated with the citrus industry might just pack it up and say, that's it, they're out of the business. Have you heard anything similar from some of the farmers who are involved in producing other fruit and vegetable crops?
Not with regards to other fruits and vegetables. It certainly was a blow for citrus. The smaller organizations were probably feeling the damage a little bit more significantly than the larger operations. And depending on the location of where a grower's operations are, they're going to be affected more, right? For example, Southwest Florida, where the hurricane made landfall, the losses were much greater there. So it certainly is affecting growers. Some will probably have to make very tough business decisions in the days and months ahead. But Florida growers are a very resilient bunch. They've been dealt pretty bad hands by Mother Nature in the past, and they've persevered. And we're certainly optimistic that the industry is going to bounce back. It may look a little different, but these are resilient folks.
And oftentimes when there's state and local authorities and federal authorities helping out, whether it's monetarily or other things, it can take a while for that help to come through. What's the picture like for growers? Is that help coming through quick enough?
Commissioner Adam Putnam, our Commissioner of Agriculture, and Governor Rick Scott, as well as our legislative delegation, are working right now very diligently to get some emergency federal funding to help growers in their recovery efforts. The delegation has asked Congress for $5 billion in aid, but unfortunately, Florida agriculture wasn't included in the federal disaster package for Harvey, Irma, and Maria that passed in October. So we're still waiting for that badly needed relief package, but we are optimistic that it will be brought up again for consideration soon.
Well, Lisa Lockridge is the Director of Public Affairs for the Florida Fruit and Vegetable Association. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Matthew.
Still to come on Intersection.
I would talk to my editor, whose name is Mara Bellaby, every single day while I was researching his case, and I would keep her up to speed. And every day we flip-flopped. Okay, he's guilty. He did it. The following day, no, he's totally innocent. And so it's just a really interesting process. I mean, I know that it's very hard and there's pressure on everybody involved, the prosecutors, the lawyers and the cops. Our big thing is everybody deserves a fair trial.
Florida Today news columnist John A. Torres joins us to talk about his award-winning podcast, Murder on the Space Coast. If you missed an episode of Intersection, listen back to previous episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. And you can also listen on the NPR One app. Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. John A. Torres says when his editor came to him with an idea for a podcast, he had to look on Wikipedia to see what a podcast is. Now, that podcast has won awards, and Torres is planning a third season. A note of caution, some of the material in the following interview may not be suitable for younger listeners. Well, John A. Torres is a news columnist with Florida Today. He spent a year investigating cases of four men who were imprisoned after wrongful convictions in Brevard County in the 1980s. Two of those men were exonerated, a third was found not guilty, and the fourth is still behind bars. Those cases are explored in the award-winning podcast, Murder on the Space Coast, John A. Torres, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure, Matt. Thanks for having me.
So give us the outline of the cases, if you will. What can you tell us about Gary Bennett? Now, he's the man who's still in prison, and what can you tell us about the three others?
Sure thing, Matt. Well, what happened was in 2004, I had covered the exoneration of, you know, Wilton Dedge, and he had spent 22 years in prison for rape, and he was cleared entirely by DNA. The semen in the rape victim was not his. A few years later, I covered the case of William Dillon, who had spent 28 years in prison for murder, and then he was cleared by DNA. And a lot of the facts of the cases were similar: the same prosecutor, the same use of jailhouse informants, the same, you know, dog handler who ended up, you know, being exposed as a fraud. So anyway, after that case, a lot of people told me that I need to look into Gary Bennett's case. And he's the fellow who you mentioned who is in prison still now for, I believe, about 34 years. And when I did my initial investigation, the prosecutors all told me, and the police, that his bloody handprints were all over the murder scene. So I didn't really touch it for a few years, because I figured he was guilty. And then when my boss asked me a few years ago to start working on a podcast, after I went onto Wikipedia and I learned what a podcast was, I chose his case, and I realized that there was only a half of a palm print in the house of the murder victim who he knew and he was neighbors with and had been in her house. And it started, you know, I just began thinking, Matt, about where my handprints are. You know, whose walls have I touched, you know, when I'm in somebody's house? If they end up dead, you know, is that, you know, an indictment of me? And so I looked at his case, and it was the same prosecutor, the same dog handler, and the same use of jailhouse informants. And as you mentioned, the fourth man, Juan Ramos, was the first of these cases, and he was found not guilty in about 2 hours on retrial when the state was not allowed to use the dog handler evidence again. So I really researched these cases, Matt. You know, I went back, I read all the trial transcripts, I got interviews with as many of the people involved as I could, and it just really seemed to be a dark time for justice here in Brevard County in the 1980s. And in fact, one of the attorneys for, I believe it was Wilton Dedge, he said that, you know, Brevard County had, you know, quote, was experiencing dark days for justice.
And it's clear from your podcast, John, that, you know, there is that theme, as you mentioned, there's the dog handler, there's the prosecutor, kind of common denominators there. And you also talk to folks from the Innocent Project of Florida. Seth Miller talks about widespread corruption and fraud as the cause of a number of wrongful convictions. I'm wondering what's changed, if anything, since the 1980s. Like, what did you find out about that in your reporting for this podcast?
Well, I think that the science, Matt, has really changed things, and the DNA and the use of DNA. So it's, I think it's a little harder to just pin something on the easy target. I think that, you know, like maybe the cops and prosecutors initially believed that all of these guys were indeed guilty, but the cases were so weak, you know, so they had to come up with stuff, and they had to make deals with informants in the jail here in Brevard County to say that, you know, either Dillon confessed or like Dedge confessed. And as we know, Matt, you don't really confess to a total stranger in jail when you're waiting to have your day in court to prove your innocence. And so, you know, all four guys were kind of easy targets. They had been in and out of jail on, like, minor stuff, you know, marijuana or, you know, pills. Or in the case of Gary Bennett, he had set a fire behind a store one time as like, a teenager. And so they were just easy targets.
So they were known to the police already. Some folks, though, you know, per your reporting, per your podcast, they haven't changed their mind. Retired Palm Bay Police Lieutenant Richard Adams, for example, he was the supervising officer during the murder investigation, that murder of Helen Nardi. And he says the right person is behind bars for her murder. I'm wondering, have you heard from folks, though, who've listened to the podcast and have changed their minds about Gary Bennett's innocence or guilt?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, Tom Davis, who is a retired FDLE agent and profiler for the state, when I gave him the entire, you know, case which I had on Bennett, and I asked him just to read through it, he said that he believed that he was guilty. And then when he heard the interview, when he heard Gary's voice, and he's a like trained FBI profiler, you know, he was, you know, he went up and he took the courses in Quantico, Virginia, and all that. And then he heard the interviews with the other folks. He totally believes that Gary was railroaded and he did not kill Helen Daugherty. And, you know, in Gary's case, you know, for those who have not listened to the podcast, obviously one of the main problems was that the state ignored obvious other suspects in the case. You know, she was having an affair with her son-in-law, who was older than she was. She had traded her children for sex in order to get a break on her rent, and her children were taken away from her. Just a lot of weird things in that. But, you know, you ask Matt what's changed, and when I was doing the podcast, I was really hoping that Phil Archer, our state attorney here in Brevard County, I was really hoping that he would be open to what I was saying and finding out, because he had nothing to do with these cases. You know, he was not there in the office when these cases happened. He was newly elected a few years ago. And I was shocked at how he backed up the prosecution no matter what. And in fact, his quote was, "Even without the dog handler evidence in Gary's case, the jury would have found him guilty." And, you know, my question back is, how on earth could you know that? You know, when the jury hears evidence, and when the jury hears that the dog handler evidence is the equivalent of a fingerprint on a murder weapon, how do you say the jury, you know, exactly what they were thinking at that time?
So what are Gary Bennett's chances for a retrial or for exoneration at this time?
They are pretty slim, unfortunately. It's mentioned in one of the podcasts. It's a weird thing. His appeals have stalled at the Fifth District Court of Appeals here in Florida, because the judges issued what's called a PCA, or a per curiam affirmed. So they affirm his verdict without an opinion. And the only way that you can appeal that further on up the line is if they issue an opinion. And so, I mean, I've heard from lawyers who are interested in the case. We have a local retired attorney who has befriended Gary and is trying to work on some legislation. There's a chance for clemency, and all that. But in his case, the DNA was destroyed, so there's nothing to test, so he can't prove his innocence, and that's the problem.
Okay, so you are now working on another season, is that correct, of Murder on the Space Coast?
Yep, and just before I head into that, I just want to tell you, Matt, that I was in Atlanta this week to cover an appeal on the Crosley Green case, and he is a, like, fifth member who, you know, like the same prosecutors, the same use of a dog handler. We did not include him in our series because it wasn't the same dog handler. However, he had just, you know, come out of jail on a drug charge, and he was the easy target, and a lot of people feel that he was not guilty as well. And in fact, Aaron Moriarty of the show on CBS called 48 Hours has profiled his case many times, and I was with her in Atlanta this week for his hearing. And so he has a little bit of hope. The appeals in his case have not stalled. So we may do a podcast on his case eventually. However, season three, Matt, we're already hard at work on, and it's a total change in direction for us, which the state attorney's office here in Brevard County would probably appreciate. It's a look at the Brandy Hall case. She was a beautiful Malabar firefighter and mother of two, who on August 17th, 2006, she vanished. She left the fire station and vanished. And her truck was found the following day in a pond, and it had her blood in it. And, I mean, that's really all we know about the case.
Sounds like you've got some work to do then on that podcast.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody has a theory. And we've also found out that she was having an affair. Her husband was about to go to jail on a drug charge. There were a lot of people who, you know, may have been unhappy with Brandy and her family. And so there's, you know, like, you know, no shortage of suspects in that case.
Working on these podcasts, working on the series, John A. Torres, has it kind of changed you as a reporter? Like, do you find you're thinking about crime now in a different way and reporting on it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Matt. You know, I'm grateful the editors here are so into the podcasts that I am given time, and, you know, which is the main thing. I'm able to read through stuff and talk to people and really think about it and really try to put myself in the, you know, in the shoes of the police officer or the prosecutor or the defense attorney, and, you know, and family members. And I'm able to hear how these crimes or how these incarcerations have affected, you know, people. And in, you know, in Gary's case, it was really interesting. I would talk to my editor, whose name is Mara Bellaby, every single day while I was researching his case, and I would keep her up to speed. And every day we flip-flopped. Okay, he's guilty. He did it. The following day, no, he's totally innocent. And so it's just a really interesting process. I mean, I know that it's very hard, and there's pressure on everybody involved, the prosecutors, the, you know, lawyers, and the cops. You know, our big thing is everybody deserves a fair trial, whether you're a loser or not, you know, whether you have any future or not, whether the cops know you for doing past, you know, misdeeds or not. Everybody should have a fair trial. And when you introduce junk science that you know is bad, and when you make deals with inmates who have done horrible things, and you cut them deals so they can help you in this prosecution, it's just not fair. It's a stacked deck, and we don't like it.
Aside from telling the story and being able to explore some of the themes you're talking about, what did you set out to achieve with the podcast, and do you feel like you've got there, you've done that?
Yeah, that's a great question. We initially just wanted to tell the story of Gary Bennett and just highlight it. And then as we went along and as people started to really listen and to get involved, we feel as if it was kind of our mission to advocate for him to get a fair trial and, you know, a, like, retrial or just any relief at all. You know, he's already served about 34 years in prison. Just let him out then. Even if you think he's guilty, he's already served a 25 to life sentence. And so we've been advocating that. And we have an Orlando congressman who is interested in the case and has contacted us. We have a state house legislator from here in Brevard County that's also contacted us and is working on some stuff behind the scenes, trying to help Gary. So I think that's exactly what we tried to do after a while. It wasn't the initial impetus for us, but I think that's what it morphed into.
Do you feel like you now have some responsibility to keep the podcast series going and look at other cases then?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, I think we may do a short, you know, little, like, one or two episode update on Gary's case in time for the holidays, including asking him what Christmas is like, you know, in prison. And so I think it's, yeah, I mean, I just want to keep his case in the news. I want to keep it at the forefront because his prosecution is, you know, being defended still.
Well, John A. Torres is news columnist with Florida Today. His award-winning podcast is called Murder on the Space Coast. John, thank you so much for your time.
Anytime, Matt. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Alana Campbell. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on the NPR One app, and you can visit us online at WMFE.org to listen back to previous episodes of Intersection. While you're there, consider making a donation and supporting us during this silent pledge drive. You can also make a contribution to local reporting and coverage of current affairs by calling 1-800-785-2020. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. I'm Matthew Petty.